Radio Prague News.
Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has ruled out speculation that a change of leadership within the Communist Party is to open the way for a coalition with the Social Democrats after next year's general elections. On an official visit to Israel, President Klaus expressed appreciation for the government's groundbreaking peace initiative. And a new court ruling has once again reversed the decision on the ownership of Opochno Chateau in eastern Bohemia. Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has ruled out speculation that a change of leadership within the Communist Party is to open the way for a coalition with the Social Democrats after next year's general elections. Mr. Paroubek told journalists that if his party should win the elections, then he would favour either a coalition with the Christian Democrats, a grand coalition, or a minority government. The Prime Minister said that the Communist Party would have to change more than its leader in order to open the way for closer cooperation. On an official visit to Israel, President Klaus expressed appreciation for the government's groundbreaking peace initiative, saying that Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip had restored faith in the Middle East peace process and that it was now up to the Palestinian leadership to show goodwill. Meeting with the Israeli President Moshe Katsav, Mr. Klaus said that the Czech Republic would support a balanced approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the European Union. A new court ruling has once again reversed the decision on the ownership of Opochno Chateau in eastern Bohemia. According to the Rychnov District Court, the chateau belongs to the National Heritage Institute, thereby to the state. Two earlier court rulings returned the chateau to the last private owners, the Colorado Mansfeld family, but the Constitutional Court abolished both verdicts in January, bringing the suit back to square one. The property was confiscated on the grounds of the post-war Benesch decrees, and the Colorado Mansfeld family has battled since 1995 to get it back. The case hinges on whether the former owner, Colorado Mansfeld, was a Czechoslovak citizen and whether he collaborated with the Nazis. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. Wednesday is expected to be partly cloudy with day temperatures between 20 and 24 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarova and that's the end of the news.
This is Radio Prague and I'm David Vaughan. In today's programme we ask, could the Communist Party be about to come in from the cold, as the party's hardline leader says he's going to step down? We'll also be remembering the moving story of thousands of young men who were made to work as forced labourers in 1950s Czechoslovakia. And in One-on-One, we talk to Chad Evans Wyatt, whose photographs take a refreshingly unconventional look at the Czech Republic's Romani community. That and more in today's programme. The long-standing leader of the Communist Party, Miroslav Grebeniček, announced his intention to resign on Monday, citing policy differences in the Communist Party leadership. Mr. Grebeniček is seen very much as a hardliner, so is his potential departure a sign of change within the party? Not necessarily, as Rob Cameron has been finding out.
The Communist Party anthem, the Internationale, ringing out over Prague's Letná Plain at the party's annual gathering of the faithful. The Communists are a powerful force in Czech politics, occupying a fifth of the seats in the lower house and scoring high in the opinion polls. And this is the man who's taken them there, Miroslav Grebeniček. Now 58, Mr. Grebeniček has led the party for more than 12 years, making him the longest-standing leader in modern Czech politics. His uncompromising tone and hard-line views have won him many supporters among the losers in the Czech Republic's post-revolutionary transformation, pensioners, the unemployed, and people on low incomes.
Well, Rob, given that he's been so successful in addressing that particular part of the electorate, I mean, why has he suddenly decided to go?
That's a very good question, and analysts are divided as to exactly what this announcement means. Some even say, David, that Mr. Grebeniček has actually no intention of going anywhere. The announcement, they believe, is more the sign of a bitter power struggle inside the Communist Party, between the hardliners gathered around Mr. Grebeniček and younger reform-minded members of the party. They see Mr. Grebeniček, who has a very sort of tub-thumping style and speaks in this old-school communist rhetoric, as unpalatable for the majority of voters. But some critics, especially on the right, such as the Civic Democrat MEP Jan Zahradil, says that replacing the man at the top is simply a cosmetic change.
Let's hear what Mr. Zahradil had to say.
Aby mohli argumentovat změnou politiky komunistické strany, pokud se dostane do jejího čela někdo.
If someone who considers himself a so-called reform communist is elected party leader, then they can argue that Communist Party policy is changing, and it could eventually mean that the suggestion of more cooperation with the communists, proposed by Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek and others, takes a more tangible form.
So what we're talking about here is some kind of closer alliance with the currently ruling Social Democrats. Do you think, Rob, that that is really in the offing?
Well, it's difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, Mr. Paroubek repeated at the weekend that he would rather see a minority Social Democrat government propped up by the communists than a coalition of social and civic democrats. However, he also said that the communists still had to come to terms properly with their totalitarian past and also support Social Democrat foreign policy, such as continuing membership of NATO and the EU.
So I suppose a big question is, who actually would replace Mr. Grebeniček?
Well, there is the man tipped to replace him is the party's deputy leader, Wojciech Filip, but there's no sign really that he would be more willing or indeed more able to do either of those two things. Mr. Filip is cut very much from the same cloth as Mr. Grebeniček. So real change inside the Communist Party, and therefore real change on the Czech political left, is still a long way off.
Well, thanks very much for that, Rob. You're tuned to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Now, the average Czech has more pocket money than his or her neighbours in fellow post-communist countries like Slovakia, Poland and Hungary. But according to a new survey out this week, there is a growing east-west divide within the Czech Republic itself, and concern that a two-speed economy is developing. Brian Kennedy has more.
The average resident of the Czech capital, Prague, has a parity purchasing power one-third greater than the national average. That is to say, for every dollar that John Q. Public, or rather Jan Novak, has in his pocket, your average Prague resident has at least another 33 cents to spend. According to a purchasing power analysis released on Tuesday by the market research companies GfK Praha and Incoma Research, the man on the street in Bruntal, a Moravian town near the border with Poland, has perhaps half the disposable income of his Prague counterpart. Incoma Research Managing Partner Tomasz Dertina says such city-by-city comparisons are crucial for retailers in deciding which goods to place on the shelves in specific outlets.
It does not mean that the situation of the person in Bruntal is twice as bad as the one in Prague. There are some things which, of course, people in Bruntal cannot afford to buy. But, for instance, they do not have to pay that much for their dwelling. But always there will be some costs which are the same in all regions. So it's natural that you cannot expect to have such high revenues in your retail store in North Moravia than from your store in Prague.
In other words, while parity purchasing power doesn't necessarily translate into a higher quality of life, it is a major factor in determining where a retailer like Tesco or Carrefour will choose to locate and what product line it will carry. And so areas like Bruntal, with high unemployment and a purchasing power that is 70% of the national average, don't benefit from the positive knock-on effects that such businesses can bring. It also means that in Moravia, people may have a harder time paying for small luxuries, such as a night out at the movies or a high-speed internet connection. Incoma has been carrying out purchasing power analyses in the Czech Republic since 1995. Mr. Dertina says that, generally speaking, the disparity between Moravia in the east and Bohemia in the west has been growing slowly but steadily over the past decade.
it's important for the retailers to estimate the potential retail spendings of people living in these areas. And it's also important for the state, I think, because state institutions can see where they expect some economic problems. But most of the clients, of course, are private companies.
The GfK Incoma research confirms that Prague is the richest region in the country. It also shows that every single region with a purchasing power higher than the national average is in Bohemia, namely Prague, Pilsen, Karlovy Vary, and Cheb, which have attracted the bulk of foreign direct investment.
Hundreds of elderly men took part in an emotional gathering at the Ministry of Defence on Monday, recalling their days in the army as young men. That was at the height of the Stalinist regime in the 50s. But they weren't regular soldiers. Not allowed to carry weapons, they were in reality forced labourers, punished by the communists for their class backgrounds. Ian Willoughby reports.
A Czech army band plays at the beginning of a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the foundation in 1950 of the Pomocne Technické Prapory, or Technical Assistance Battalions. Members were officially soldiers, but the estimated 50,000 young men forced to join were used for other purposes. Among the guest speakers was Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek.
Nastupovali ze dne na den do této zvláštní.
Overnight, they joined this strange military service without weapons, in which they never knew how long they would have to serve. In reality, they had to work deep in mines, in quarries and forests, on the building of tunnels, roads and airports. It was forced labour.
The hardest and most dangerous work for Pete Paci, as they were known, was in the mines. Some were killed, and others suffered poor health for years afterwards. In 1951, Vladislav Socek was sent to Orlova, a town he'd never heard of. His story is not unusual.
Hrála nám tam hornická hudba, cestička k Majerovce, tak jsem pochopil, že jsem jinde než...
On the train they were playing miners' music, so I understood that I was going to the mines. It was really hard work, and we got very little training. The mine I worked in was one of the most dangerous, and there were frequent explosions. It had actually been shut after a big explosion in 1947, and they sent us soldiers in instead of regular miners. So we were like guinea pigs. Imagine going underground without ever being certain that you would come back up.
Jedete dolů a 100% jistotu, že pojedete po směně nahoru, nemáte nikdy.
Mr. Socek, now in his 70s, was forced to join because his father owned land, and he was therefore regarded as unreliable by the communist regime. One of his brothers without arms, Mr. Hirsch from Jindřichov Hradec, served 3 years in the technical assistance battalions.
No, bylo nám nejhůř v roku 52, pokud nám ohlásili, že jsme...
The worst time for us was in 1952, when they said we'd have to serve indefinitely. By the way, we know today that there were even plans to send us to Siberia. Unfortunately, when we got out, we bore the tag politically unreliable our whole lives and through our working lives, so it stayed with us until our retirement, and thank God for
1989.
Since 1989, the former members of the Technical Assistance Battalions have built up a close, brotherly organization. May they have many more reunions.
You're tuned to Radio Prague. In possible cases of bioterrorist attacks or leaks of dangerous substances into the environment, efficient detection and early warning systems could save many lives. Czech scientists have developed a special optical sensor, a device that can detect dangerous biological substances in the environment. And Pavla Horáková spoke to Jiří Homola from the Institute of Radio Engineering and Electronics in Prague to ask him how exactly the optical sensor works.
Well, our sensor uses a special type of electromagnetic wave, so-called surface plasmon, which propagates along a very thin layer of gold. we immobilize a special biomolecular receptors such as antibodies on the surface of the sensor, and then bring a sample, which is usually a liquid, into contact with the surface of the chip or the sensor. When the capture of analyte on the receptors occurs, a change of speed of the surface plasmon occurs, and we can measure that change of speed very precisely.
And which substances can be detected by the sensor?
The great advantage of this approach is that it can be combined with receptors for many different kinds of analytes. So analytes can include certain chemicals, hormones, toxins, bacteria, etc. In addition, our sensors have a multi-analyte capability which allows them to detect multiple analytes at the same time.
Can you describe the appliance? What does it look like?
Well, we have developed a whole variety of sensor platforms. They range from large, high-performance tabletop laboratory systems to highly miniaturized fiber optic probes for operation in hard-to-access locations. Currently, we are finishing the first prototype of a mobile sensor unit for rapid detection of biological substances in the field. The whole sensor system is of the size of a shoebox and is connected to a laptop for data acquisition and processing. The sensor runs from batteries and should be able to operate in the field for up to 10 hours.
And what are the potential situations in which this device can be applied?
Well, there are numerous existing and emerging applications for this technology. These include early warning systems for detection and identification of potentially hazardous substances in public places, mobile systems for food safety inspectors, systems for continuous environmental monitoring, diagnostics tool for rapid detection of human health indicators such as hormones and antibodies, etc.
Have you cooperated with any international institutions in the development of the device?
Yes, this is a highly interdisciplinary research in which we collaborate with research institutions and universities worldwide. We have a very strong collaboration with the University of Washington in Seattle and a grant awarded to us by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We are working on the next generation of detection technologies for pathogens and toxins for food safety. Besides the FDA, this research is sponsored by Czech National Foundation and European Commission.
And now on to our regular feature, One on One with Rob Cameron.
My guest in this week's One-on-One is the American photographer Chad Evans Wyatt, whose collection of portraits of middle-class Czech Roma is currently on display at Prague Castle. Chad, who grew up in New York and is now based in Washington, was driven by a desire to challenge traditional stereotypes of the country's large Roma minority, showing Romanese who have battled discrimination to become regular members of Czech society. When Chad came into the studio recently, I began by asking him how his photographic career began.
I was born in New York City of parents who were musicians, both of them professionals, one working classically in voice and the other a jazz musician to become a classical organist later on in his life. I dearly wanted to be a jazz clarinetist, the next best thing in big thing in jazz clarinet. But at the age of 16, my mother sat me down and said, "You really don't have the talent to continue as a musician. You absolutely must be top-notch to do such a thing." Coming from my mother, a professional musician, this was not welcome news, but it was believable. And I eventually wandered toward a career in international economics, but discovered I was kind of bored with that. And one Christmas, my mother gave me a camera, and I said to myself, "Wow, this is music with light." And immediately set about reading 50 books and eventually stumbled into being a photographer, self-made.
Tell me how you became involved in the Roma community of the Czech Republic.
I became involved in a very nice way. I photographed a project in the 90s called The 101 Artists of the Czech Republic, a survey of artists in the Czech Republic during the 90s post-revolution. Among them, of course, were Roma, artists, among them the very famous Piera Bila Akale singing group. But a lesser-known one, Yarushka Gondolanova, told me over lunch one day that, in her opinion, the media really avoided, assiduously avoided, discussing the fact that there was a middle class and a professional class among the Roma. And this rang a bell in me because when I grew up in New York City, for the time I was there, in our apartment came quite often people who were professionals, doctors, lawyers, and they were black, and they were preparing what became the civil rights era of the 1950s. I was a very young guy, but there it was. I'd always wanted to go back retrospectively and photograph the civil rights era, and here was an opportunity within the Roma to try this, obviously a different place, different kind, try it again.
And so that's how the Roma Rising Project came about, to show a different image of Roma people than the usual stereotype of a minority living in poverty, discriminated against, and so on.
Those stereotypes resonated so well with me because blacks in the U.S. were subject to very similar stereotypes. I emphasize here that the black experience in the U.S. and the Roma experience in Europe are very, very, very different. So I'm not confused in that, but there are similarities, and the stereotypes are one very important aspect of that.
Now, the photos currently on display at Prague Castle, they include Romani journalists, Romani doctors, even a Romani policewoman. How did you find them?
I first sought out Monica Horakova, who at the time was the sole Romani deputy in the House of Deputies, and asked her the very question that was in my mind: are there such people? And she said, of course there are, and here is a list of people you might seek out. Among them were some leaders, and I thought at the time it was probably good to pursue leaders so that I might get introductions to other people. In fact, the way it happened was I photographed leaders at the very beginning and then no more. After that, I was pursuing the people I really wanted, who were cab drivers, small businessmen, people who lead ordinary middle-class lives. Also, of course, the more impressive doctors, lawyers, you know, that sort of thing. But I was interested in finding the unknown who lived in plain sight. And I found them. And I can tell you also that just because I came away with 86 portraits, total of 100 people or so, there are many, many more. There was not enough time to find them all.
Now, you quote Abraham Lincoln to describe the people in the photographs, calling them better angels of our nature. What were they like to work with?
There was a great deal of caution because these people, all of them, have been approached by numerous photographers over decades who seem always to come away with the same image repeated over and over as Xerox quality. In the end, bearing none of the essence of the great and seminal Czech photographer Josef Kaudelka's very famous series on gypsies, which went to the core of the gypsy experience. Now you see these photographers doing emulations of a guy they probably don't even know about. And I wanted to bring to the table a different kind of picture, a portrait of respect within a kind of studio context, black and white rather than garish color, in order to allow a contemplation. And all of this was observable by the people involved. They, in turn, talked to one another and said, you know, this guy is serious. I think you should cooperate with him. So there was a kind of a snowball. It started slowly. I had to prove myself. It didn't hurt that I'm half black. I didn't mention that before, but my father was black, my mother white. And it certainly didn't hurt that I had a musician's background. But I think the approach was what really persuaded people that I was serious and not intending to take advantage of anyone.
You also say on your website that the human spirit can, despite prejudice and denial, rise to its level of ambition and excellence. And I think I'd be right in saying that few, very few, ordinary Czechs would agree with that sentiment when applied to their Romani neighbours. Do you think your photos can change that?
I accept the notion that the photographs I did are of people who are exceptional in the sense that they have had to labor against not only the color of their skin, the prejudice of neighbors, but also the consideration even among those in the educational field who believe that Romani cannot absorb education and have observed, they feel over time, that there is little sense of responsibility of tomorrow among the Romani. This, again, is analogous to a view held among whites in the U.S. 100 years ago. The blacks, certainly, who danced and sang and played music and, you know, irresponsible, could not become doctors and lawyers. They have labored because they felt they must succeed. They labored against danger, against prejudice, and against even the prejudice within their own community. Let us not forget that if you rise above your group in some fashion and become a doctor, you're thought suspect as well. So imagine these people out there alone. I find them extraordinary. Yes, better angels of our nature in that we all wish to succeed. We all wish to strive. And these people did it.
Right. On that note, we must leave it. Chad, thank you very much indeed.
Great pleasure to be with you.
And you can see Chad Evans-Wyatt's photographs of prominent and successful Czech Roma at the Royal Summer Palace at Prague Castle until the end of October. That's all we have time for here on Radio Prague. So from me, David Vaughan, and all of us here, goodbye.
Ici Radio Prague, programme en langue française des émissions internationales de la radio tchèque, Onde Courte. Pour bénéficier de la humble réception, voici la grille de nos horaires en temps universel et fréquence en kilohertz. Six heures, 6h27, Europe. 5930, 7345. 7h30, 7h57, Europe. 9880, 11600. 16h30, 16h57, Europe, Afrique Centre. 5930, 17485. 18h30, 18h57. Europe, Afrique Ouest, 5930, 13580. 22h, 22h27, Amérique du Nord, 9415, 7345. Nous vous invitons à l'écoute sur le web. Pour cela, veuillez vous connecter au site www.radio.cz/français. Radio Prague est aussi sur le satellite. Vous trouverez toutes les informations sur notre site www.radio.cz.